That was cellist David Aegis from his first album, The Captain. His new album's called The Arrow, and it's a series of duets with alto saxophonist Byard Lancaster. David Aegis will be with us in a little while on Fresh Air, and we'll sample selections from his new album. By the way, the saxophonist on the selection we just heard was Mark Whitecage. It's 21 minutes to 3. This is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My guest, Jerry Mangione, is known for his books, nonfiction, fiction, autobiography, about Italian-American life. In 1942, his book Montalegro was published by Houghton Mifflin. It was his autobiographical story of growing up in a Sicilian neighborhood in Rochester, where his large extended family all lived as well. It was published again in 1952 by Knopf, published again in 1963 as part of Hill and Wang's American Century series. In 1972, Crown published it, targeting it to a teenage audience. Well, Montalegro has just been published once again, this time by the Columbia University Press. Jerry Mangione is a professor emeritus of American literature at the University of Pennsylvania. His other recent books include An Ethnic at Large, A Memoir of America in the 30s and 40s, and The Dream and the Deal, The Federal Writers Project, 1935 to 1943. He's the coordinator of cultural events at the University of Pennsylvania's Italian Studies Center, and he's currently working on a comprehensive study of the Italian-American experience from 1880 to 1980. Jerry Mangione, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be here, Terry.
There's a kind of irony, as I recall the last time you visited with us. We were talking about how one of your books was was threatened with the
destruction.
Destruction, yeah.
That's right.
Because it was too expensive to keep an inventory of,
that's right,
of books. It would be cheaper to destroy them so you wouldn't have to pay the taxes. And
yes,
here's your 1942 book getting
resurrecting for the fifth time. Malcolm Cowley wrote me a letter recently. He said that no other book of our time has had so many lives as Montalegro. And it is extraordinary for a book to have five publishers, you know. It's just it's hard to explain. It's had a different publisher for every decade, oddly enough. I don't know of any book that's had this curious history.
What do you think that's happened?
Well, I think every publisher who reads it thinks, gee, this should sell a million, you know, and of course it doesn't. And so they let it go out of print, and then I have to pick up the ball and or the book and find another publisher. And I have such faith in the book and its ability to remain vivid through the years, and it doesn't go out of date. So that I've had the salesmanship in me to present it to other publishers and interest them. The last time this happened was kind of funny, though. The book had been published in 72 for teenagers, mind you. This is because suddenly the Philadelphia school system needed 2,000 copies in a hurry, so a publisher was found very easily. And then the question came up, should it be published as an adult book or as a teenage book? And so it was published as a teenage book because it was going to a high school audience. It didn't make any difference to me. After all, Mark Twain's books go to teenagers. Anyway, so then they let it go out of print at a very bad time because ethnicity was becoming extremely popular. And I decided it needed another publisher. And one day I was looking through the Authors Guild and I saw this Italian name, William Germano, who's the editor of Columbia University Press Morningside Books. So I thought, an Italian name. So I called him and I said, Mr. Germano, have you ever heard of a book called Montalegro? He said, no. Well, that sort of took me back a bit, but he did go to the library. He read it. He was very enthusiastic about it. Next time I was in New York, we signed the contract. But it is odd that it should go from being a book for teenagers, to a book published by a scholarly press.
The first time it was published in the early 1940s, it was published as fiction, when in fact it was
It was
your
nonfiction.
Story.
Yeah. I wrote it as nonfiction, and then at the last minute, practically about a month before publication, the publishers decided, or its sales department decided, that it would sell better as fiction than as nonfiction. In those days, fiction did sell better. And I protested very vehemently, but it was my first book. I had no clout, and my agent did not back me up. So finally, I had to give in to this strange transformation of a book of nonfiction suddenly becoming a book of fiction. All I did, I changed the names of all the characters. And I had a tongue-in-cheek notice in the front to the effect that if anyone recognized himself in the book, to please bear in mind that this is a book of fiction. I was very lucky in choosing a different name for Mangione. Mangione, by the way, which means big eater. I changed that to Amoroso, which means lover, which somehow is more pleasing. But I had I wasn't as lucky changing the name of my aunt, whose name was Teresa, and I changed it to Giovanna, and the poor woman was mortified. It seems, I didn't know this until it was too late, that Giovanna was the name of a Sicilian queen given to sexual excesses. And this poor dear woman, who considered me her favorite nephew, was suddenly confronted by this gossip that she had been named after a Sicilian queen of that nature.
Well, did you tell her it was all fiction and she had no need to worry?
I don't think she knew the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Although ethnic pride is almost fashionable now, when you wrote that book, assimilation was really what everybody was after. Was it?
Well, it was different than, the melting pot theory was then very popular. I never believed in it, but it was extremely popular. The idea was that you became Americanized as quickly as possible and forgot and just put behind you your whatever European culture had brought with you or had given to your children. So there was this Americanization campaign that went on for many, many years. And this is rather destructive because many people of foreign ancestry try to conceal their ancestry, which is rather stupid, but it seemed almost necessary at times. For example, I remember a cousin who was offered a job with the proviso that she change her name. Her name was obviously Italian. They wanted her to use a waspish name. She needed the job, and she did it.
Did you, after you left the neighborhood and wrote a book about the neighborhood you grew up in, were you transformed by that? You know, since you were an outsider for having left it, but such a part of the community for having written about it and for having had to reflect on it so much in order to write about it.
Well, I think perhaps in a sense I've always been an outsider. Even growing up, I was a rather shy kid, and I tended to be more objective, perhaps, than I should have been. I should have had more fun. But I also felt that I was living a double life, that I was being a Sicilian at home where English was not spoken, and on the street I was supposed to be an American, and in the classroom. And I felt a certain conflict. I didn't see how in the world I could lead this double life, and I felt that I should get away from it and find out whether I was a Sicilian or an American. And so I had to learn to sort of straddle both cultures, and it's a good idea to do that. At least it's worked very well for me.
You wrote a final chapter to Mount Allegro that is about your return to the neighborhood you grew up in, which has changed quite a bit since the time you were growing
yes.
up. Can you compare for us what it was like then and what it's like now?
Actually, it wasn't a Sicilian neighborhood or even an Italian-American neighborhood. There were many of my relatives who lived in that neighborhood, but it was a mixed ethnic neighborhood. It was largely Jewish, many Poles, and I think the third ranking population was the Italian population. So it was a nice mix, and we played together. We never thought of each other's ethnic background. We were more worried about whether the gang on the next street would get to play on the playground that we wanted to use, and there were these kinds of fights, although nothing like modern gang fights. We just threw stones, that's all. Anyway, it was sort of a semi-slum neighborhood. I hadn't realized it was a slum neighborhood until a settlement house organized a club called the Aurorans of boys in the neighborhood, sort of made sure that we came under proper influence, and the man's name was Smith or something like this. He was a very nice man who worked in a bank all of the week and then did his community service by meeting with us and providing guidance. And I hadn't realized what a disadvantaged neighborhood it was until he invited us all to his country club. Incidentally, in this club, there were 13 Jews and Mangione. And I never thought of it until years later that I would have been outvoted had there been any votes. But it wasn't a question of voting. It was simply a question of being together. And they were among the members were people who were very close friends of mine. And I gravitated to them because they read books and very few other people did. Anyway, so he took us to this fancy country club, and we went tobogganing in the moonlight, and then we were treated to the most luxurious meal that any of us had ever seen, and we felt very disadvantaged at that point, especially after we found out that this very country club discriminated against membership of Jews and Italians. Those were the two groups that were not very popular in the eyes of the community leaders.
What's the neighborhood like now?
Oh, it's nothing. It's gone. It became a victim of urban renewal or urban removal, as it, more accurate, because after this neighborhood was torn down, there's nothing there now except a church where I used to confess my sins. Everything else, you can't even find the streets. And in the area where my parents and where I grew up is a $5 million Coca-Cola bottling plant with a barbed wire fence around it. And within that area is where my father used to sit around with his friends and relatives and drink homemade wine.
Does it break your heart to see it gone, or do you just expect that?
Well, it's very sad and very strange feeling to see your past literally wiped out. And it evokes Gertrude Stein's sentence, when you get there, there's no there there. And it's very empty kind of a feeling. A Rochester newspaper ran most of that last chapter in their Sunday supplement with a map of the area and also a interview with some of the people who live there. And one of them, who's a priest, seemed to object to the fact that I said the neighborhood was gone. And, of course, it is gone. I mean, there are a few people around there. But he felt that, perhaps he was being protective of his parish, but he felt that there was a neighborhood nonetheless. It's not very visible.
Most of your family had moved before the time
that it was
torn apart.
My mother was the, in that house where we all grew up, my mother remained as long as she could. My brother had a grocery store a couple blocks away, and she felt he was so close that she was perfectly all right there, although the neighborhood had declined badly. And she made friends with her neighbors. She had blacks on one side and Puerto Ricans on another, and they were very good friends, and she felt safe. But one night, some hoodlums went by in a car, and they threw a beer can through the living room and almost struck her. And so that clinched it, and my brother moved her to my sister's house, which is in the suburbs. And then later on, his grocery store was demolished, urban renewal, and he too moved to the suburbs. So everyone has gone to the suburbs. Interestingly enough, these suburbs, I find, are often populated by other Italian Americans. There is a sort of a feeling of, I don't think it's done deliberately, it just sort of happens that way. Perhaps they prefer certain neighborhoods, and they find themselves living practically next door.
Well, how did all your family end up in the same neighborhood in the first place?
Rochester. Oh, well, my father and mother, first of all, they met in Rochester, although they came from towns that were just a few miles apart in Sicily. They never met till they got to Rochester. And for a while they lived in an area that was known as Little Italy, which is all Italian. And then when the Irish began to abandon this other neighborhood, which is quite a distance away, although still center city, property values went down. The Irish were getting away from these terrible people that were moving in, the Italians. Later on, of course, they were, when communication was established, they were to intermarry a great deal. But at that time, there was a definite feeling of hostility on the part of the Irish. And so my father and mother got a piece of property in this area called, which I call Mount Allegro, which there's nothing mountainous about it. It's just a flat prairie plain. But I had picked out that name in a desperate search for a title, and also it had a kind of a cheerful sound to it, which expressed the general mood that I found among in my family and among my relatives. Although there's a great deal of sadness, I try to suggest that in the final chapter, the new chapter I've written.
Well, you mentioned in the book even that there was a, I think it was your father's father who had committed suicide, and
yes,
that there was always this fear in the family that
there
might be something like that, that the depression or anxiety might be so overwhelming at some point.
Yes, it infected the whole family, this anxiety, this feeling that something terrible might happen of that sort.
Did you reread your book before it was published again?
I did for the first time in 40 years because I wanted to... I found a few typographical errors, and it was
that's not all
it was
you
a
can
strange
say about the experience.
Rereading something, you know, it's as if you're reading somebody else's work, and I sort of felt envious in a way about the fellow who wrote that, because I mean, I think I've gained perhaps in other ways. That is in I've become more mature, of course, and my perceptions are deeper. But nonetheless, I think I've lost a certain sharpness of wit that I could convey to papers. Nowadays, whatever wit I have comes out verbally, but I don't extend it so much to my writing. Although, as you know, I have written at least one book of humor deliberately.
Well, you know, it's funny. I guess when you read back things that you wrote years ago, you're either going to feel like you really had something then, or the worser thing, I think, is to feel like, gee, to think I thought that was good at the time that I wrote it.
Yeah.
That's a terrible feeling.
That is. I've read manuscripts of mine and been very happy that they never got printed. I must say I feel very good about Mount Allegro. I think it will outlive all of us.
So, in your own family and in the family, the continuing extended family of the people who you write about in Mount Allegro, is the Italian American tradition still being observed, maintained?
Well, I think to a considerable extent, not entirely. Of course, life has changed. I mean, communications are quicker and people move around more. When I went to Syracuse University from Rochester, it was considered a very radical thing for me to have done, to leave my family and go 90 miles away to live among strangers. This seemed horrible to them. And now, of course, I mean, things have changed so much. People commute from California to Rochester and think nothing of it. So there's there are many changes. The family can't get together as often as it would like to, and, of course, as often as it used to. But it does get together, and the food is amazingly similar to the food that I remember growing up. That tradition is certainly maintained. There are many other changes, of course, the whole attitude toward American morality, if I may call it that, has changed. There's no longer the feeling that a divorced a person is an evil person. There's also an understanding that it's quite possible to marry a person who is not Italian and have a happy married life than used to be. There was great suspicion, and understandably, there was very little communication.
Well, I'm glad your book is back in print again, and I want to thank you very much for talking
with us. If anyone wants to hear me read that final chapter, which is called Finale, I think you have the information.
Yeah, this is going to be November 15th, which is next Sunday, not this coming Sunday. I believe that's a week from this Sunday.
Right.
And that's at the Benjamin Franklin Room of Euston Hall on the University of Pennsylvania campus. It's free and open to the public. Let me give you a phone number in case you want any more information. It's 243-8279. That's, again, a reading that Jerry Mangione will give of the last chapter of his book, Mount Allegro, and that's the chapter in which he returns to the old neighborhood, which barely exists anymore, and reflects upon the changes. So that's November 15th, a week from this Sunday, 3 o'clock, in the Ben Franklin Room of Euston Hall on the University of Pennsylvania campus. And the book, again, that has just been reissued, and this is its fourth life, I believe?
Fifth,
all right.
Yes.
It's called Mount Allegro, and the publisher is the University of Columbia Press. Right. Thanks very much for visiting with us.
It's good to be here.
It's 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I just want to mention in an hour, Bill Siemering will be with us. He's WUHY's station manager, and about once a month, he joins us on Fresh Air to talk about program schedule changes and new programs, and we'll open up the phones, as we usually do, to take your questions and comments about our program. From David Egis's new album, The Arrow, we heard Sweetness is Beauty. David Egis is my guest on Fresh Air. And for some reason that I'm not really sure of, there have been very few jazz cellists. Ron Carter and Oscar Pettiford have recorded sessions, but their first instrument has always been bass. David Egis, as a cellist, has been developing rhythmic and tonal possibilities for the instrument. He does everything you can do with a string instrument, plucking, bowing, strumming. He plays mostly his own compositions, which he's recorded, by the way, on his first album, The Captain, as well as on this new album, The Arrow. The Arrow is an album of duets with saxophonist Byard Lancaster, who lived in Philadelphia for many years, and I think he's recently moved to New York. But he and David have been making frequent trips to Philadelphia to rehearse with Philadelphia-based drummer Sonny Murray, and their group will be performing in Boston later this month. David Egis is classically trained. He's a graduate of the Manhattan School of Music. And welcome back, David, for a return visit to Fresh Air. It's nice to see you.
Oh, it's good to see you, Terry. It's a pleasure being here.
You know, when I was telling people that you were a jazz cellist, and they'd say, wow, how interesting. I have a feeling that they would imagine you playing a kind of light and swinging jazz as opposed to this really, I don't know how to describe it. I'm not very good at describing music, but it's not, I think, what they were imagining. I know you're classically trained, but it sounds like you've always listened to jazz, and it's not something you recently learned after classical music.
Yes, that's true. I have listened to jazz for many years, and I do feel it's very much a part of my musical background and the music I play now. And as far as the music I play, I always have felt that the compositions that I've written have been equally, if not more important than the fact that I play the cello in jazz. And in fact, I started writing music so I could play the cello in jazz because there really wasn't any model for playing the cello in this music. So this is how I started doing it.
Why not? Why isn't there more cellists who play jazz? It doesn't seem to be anything about the instrument that makes it impossible to participate in jazz.
Well, I don't know why exactly it was that way, but I do think that it's always the cello has always been thought of as a classical instrument until recently, and now there have been several cellists playing jazz and playing improvised music on this instrument, the cello. I think that it was just not realized the fact that you could do so much on the cello in jazz. You could play it like a horn, like I do in The Captain. You could play it like a guitar, like a bass, like I do on this new record, The Arrow. And, of course, as I say, I feel like the compositions are an integral part of the music that I play and that the cello is just a vehicle for the compositions, really.
What have you kept and what have you thrown out from your classical training?
Well, I think what I've kept is a certain kind of formality in the composition where I order things very rigorously and there's a real structure in the music. I think I also have kept a certain kind of a discipline as far as the technical facility on the instrument, which I studied for many years with some very fine teachers. What I haven't kept is the kind of rigidity, the attitude that many classical musicians have towards music, which is that the music is sort of somewhere else, and then they have to approach it. But I feel like the music has to come from inside you, and this is why I started playing this music, because I could never really feel that close to most of the music I was playing, with the exception of some Bach suites and things like that, solo suites for cello. But so that is why I really started playing this music, because that's what I was hearing in my head, and I felt that this was the expression of the contemporary and of myself and the contemporaries that I was living with and of this age. So this is why I'm playing this kind of music and writing this kind of music.
When you say writing music, I mean, you're writing it, but you're also improvising it as well. What kind of structure do you like to give, particularly for the improvisational part of a piece?
Well, the composition and the improvisation is very closely related. In fact, the compositions that I write are directed so that the improvisation will be directed in a certain way. And I use various forms. For example, I think you were playing just Sweetness is Beauty just now, and that is really like a blues. It also has certain folk song elements in it, and it does have a harmonic chordal structure, which is fairly unusual for me, but I did feel that I wanted to provide a vehicle for Beyer to solo, and I think he plays a very, very fine solo on that particular tune. And this is, you know, one example of the kind of forms that I do. Other forms, for example, on the new record, The Arrow, include, say, Swimming Under the Good Old American Flag, which is another composition that I wrote. And this is something where Beyer continues to sort of vary and repeat the melody while I play a solo over it. So he is like, it's sort of like a theme and variations type thing.
We're going to hear that in a few minutes, but
okay.
The piece I'd like to play now is the piece that opens the album, and it's called Jumpin' Jenny. Do you want to say a little bit about how that's put together?
Sure, that's just a blues riff, really, and it's not even written down. I just had a certain structure in mind, which I pretty much sang to Byard, and that's how we got that one together.
Well, let's hear it. And this is from the new David Aegis album, The Arrow, which is, by the way, on his own record label. And it's called Jumpin' Jenny, and it's a duet with David Aegis on cello, along with Byard Lancaster on alto. Thank you. From cellist and composer David Aegis' new album, The Arrow, we just heard Jumpin' Jenny. That was Byard Lancaster featured with him on alto saxophone. The album is a series of duets, the compositions all by David Aegis, who is my guest in the studio. And I'd like to tell you that you could hear him perform sometime soon in Philadelphia, but he does not have a scheduled concert in the near future. However, he and Byard have been performing with Sonny Murray, and I can mention that Sonny Murray will be performing in concert this Saturday night at the Foxhole. And it will be the Drums Interactual group with a lot of drummers, Sonny Murray and percussionists, Sonny Murray, Khan Jamal, Ed Blackwell, Steve McCall, Dennis Charles. That will be this Saturday night at performance at the Foxhole, which will be at the International House. Well, David, you strum your cello, which is something, a technique that is probably pretty personal.
Yes,
how did you arrive at that? What have you done with the instrument to figure out all the different sounds you can get out of it and the different ways you could work with it?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that I played blues guitar when I was a teenager, and I listened to a lot of the blues guitarists like Lightnin' Hopkins and Robert Johnson and John Lee Hooker, and these made a very deep impression on me. And I think what I've done is translated that kind of playing onto the cello. And so that is something that took quite a while to evolve, that kind of style, but it is a technique that I've developed, and I feel very good about it. I think it's very effective, particularly in this kind of setting with just a duet setting. I also use it quite a bit in the trio that I have with Byard Lancaster and Sonny Murray, and will be performing soon in Boston. And this is something that also, I think, gives a lot of rhythmic vitality to the music, and is something that I really like using the cello for.
It's almost like rhythm guitar in a way.
Yes, it is. The cello is really a great instrument for jazz because you can use it in so many different ways. You can use it as a horn, like I mentioned in The Captain, with like a saxophone and playing saxophone lines on it, or you can use it as a combination bass guitar. And this is something that I've been doing a lot lately, and I like it very much. I like working with the instrument in that way, and particularly in conjunction with Sonny, who of course is a fantastic drummer. And I've been enjoying the rehearsals with the trio very much with Byard and Sonny, and this is, I think, a group that I would like to keep for some time.
Since you're classically trained, I'd really be interested in hearing what you think of some of the albums recorded by classical musicians, like the Jean-Pierre Rampal, Claude Bolling collaborations. Does that kind of classically oriented jazz appeal to you?
Well, I understand. I have a friend that works at CBS Masterworks. In fact, he's the head of the international marketing division of CBS Masterworks, and he gives me the stories, the inside stories behind these albums. They sell very, very well, by the way. I mean, in the hundreds of thousands. Now, I can't say personally that they're my favorite music, but I mean, they're obviously very effective, and I think what they've done is sort of taken the lightness of classical music and the lightness of jazz, I mean, the lighter aspects of both of those musics, and put them into an extremely accessible package. And, I mean, hell, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not the kind of music that I'm really interested in playing with.
Do you have much time to listen to music?
Oh, yes, I listen to music quite a bit.
What have you been listening to?
Well, I've been listening to Milton Nascimento. He's a very interesting Brazilian composer and guitarist and singer, and I think he's very, very effective. I've also been listening to a lot of African music. In fact, I think some of my newer compositions, which I would like to be recording with a trio very soon, have some African influence in them. And I, as a matter of fact, even took a course in African music and studied it, not really deeply in depth, but enough to give me a pretty good overview of the music that's coming from that continent. And it's really remarkable. I'm really
You listening to like African popular music or
no, more the African tribal
music.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So it would be difficult for me to understand immediately what it is you'd get from that would apply to, for instance, what you're doing in a duet setting where there isn't any percussion. You play percussively, but that's different.
Yes, well, that's the direction I'm going in, is the fact that I am playing percussively, and also it sort of reinforces my theory that melody and rhythm are interchangeable, and that melody can be very rhythmic and rhythm can be very melodic. And, of course, African music, the African tribal music, is often what I call mellow rhythmic. And I feel my music is somewhat that way also. And so this is something that I'm very interested in developing this concept of the melody being rhythmic and the rhythm being melodic. And this is something that I think is very important to music in general and my music in particular.
It's the kind of thing you sit down and explain to someone who's playing with you, or does that word part, the more theoretical part, not really enter into it when you're playing?
Not really. We haven't discussed the theoretical aspects of music too much. I think we've developed a rapport that is Byard and myself, and now that Sonny has joined the group, that we're developing a rapport that is more just playing different kinds of music and all the various musical experiences that we've had, and somehow we mesh and we share the musical experiences and to make a new music, which is what we're doing now.
I was trying to imagine like what kind of scene there is for musicians like you in New York, and I really couldn't come up with one, and I was wondering if there is in fact a scene at all, or if playing jazz, particularly this kind of jazz, is becoming a more isolated experience than jazz used to be.
It is. It really is. I think the past year or two, it's become more isolated. At least I have felt that way. And I think several years ago, there was a real loft scene, many people were playing in lofts. Of course, nobody was making much money doing it, but a lot of people were playing a lot of music and, I think, developing their art. Of course, you do have to go beyond that, and you can't continue to play for that kind of audience or that kind of money. So I think it has become more isolated. I know for myself that I'm very interested in recording. I think this is the real place where the music can be really heard. I mean, if I even could make like one or two good records a year, I'd be pretty happy with that. And of course, the Arrow was recorded last year, and I would like to record the trio this year. And this is something that I feel is really the direction that I'm going in. I'm also very interested in producing other artists. I have always listened to a great deal of music, and I feel very sympathetic and empathetic to a variety of music and musicians, and I feel that this is something that I would very much be interested in doing, is working with other artists in the recording studio and helping them get a finished product and even possibly putting it on my own label.
You're interested in musicians who play like you or differently from you?
Oh, differently, because I'm already doing what I do, so I don't necessarily want somebody who plays like me, but I'm really more interested in some people that perhaps would have a wider audience than my music. I feel very committed to the kind of music that I play, but at the same time I feel very realistic about, you know, the numbers of people that are going to listen to this music, and I do feel that that this is something where I could use my ability as a musician, as a producer, to expand my horizons.
Let's listen to another selection from your album, and this is, we're going to hear Swimming Under the Good Old American Flag, which you started to describe before, so maybe you could just reiterate that for us before we hear it.
Certainly. Swimming Under the Good Old American Flag has a unison theme, and then Byard continues to vary and repeat the theme where I play a solo, and this is just really a theme in variations, Swimming Under the Good Old American Flag.
Okay, so this is another selection from the new David Aegis album, The Arrow, and it's a duet with David Aegis and Byard Lancaster. Thank you. Just heard a selection from David Aegis's latest album, The Arrow, a series of duets with Byard Lancaster, compositions by David Aegis. This is called Swimming Under the Good Old American Flag. John Zwed will be with us in just a few minutes on Fresh Air for this week's edition of The Record Show. You were mentioning before how much you really enjoying working with Byard Lancaster and with Sonny Murray. Is it hard to find people who you can just automatically communicate musically with? It's like, is it as hard as finding like a really good friend?
Well, it's not that difficult, but I do feel very happy to be working with Byard and Sonny, and I do think that these two musicians in particular and myself do have a rapport that we're developing, which I think is very unique and very strong and very unusual. And this is something that I would like to see grow and develop over the years. And so I have had quite a few people pass through my groups, and I feel fairly sure of who I want and who, you know, I can really work with, and I know that this is a very good grouping.
Does the black-white thing matter much in music anymore?
Well, it doesn't seem to in my instance. I think there have been cases where there probably has been, but I think that I have the respect of the black musicians and that I know that I respect the black musicians, and so there doesn't seem to be much problem as far as that's concerned.
Do you ever look at what some of your former classmates at the Manhattan School of Music are doing and wonder what you would be doing if you had a classical music career?
Well, I do keep in touch with one person in particular who was roommate of mine when I was attending the Manhattan School of Music. And he does a lot of freelance work in New York. He does things like the American Ballet Theater, and he does some string quartet playing and various things like that. And I do feel that I feel much more fulfilled in my own musical career, the fact that I've gone with what I've heard and developed my own style of playing and composing. And of course, economically, it is not as easy as just fitting into a slot that's already there, because you do have to create your own route. But I do think that as the years go by and that the economics will catch up with me, and that I feel very good about what I'm doing.
How do you define success for yourself?
Well, I feel that I would like very much to be able to produce other artists on my own label, Music Unlimited Records, and produce my own work as well, and release a good record, say, about every 9 months. That would be a success for me in the fact that I could continue to produce and create my own music, as well as producing other artists, which would possibly have a wider market than my own music, which would support my music. And if I could release 4 or 5 records a year with my own productions on my own label, I would be very happy.
I know you've been coming to Philadelphia to do some rehearsing, and it made me wonder if maybe it's impossible to find a place to do it in Manhattan, because if you don't live in Soho, if you don't live in a loft space, say you live in an apartment building, you'd have probably a lot of angry neighbors on your hands if you brought in a drummer and a horn player. How do you practice in Manhattan?
Well, actually, I'm very fortunate in the fact that the manager of my building likes music, and I have had bands rehearse there. I've had a quartet rehearse there with drums and bass and horns and myself. I don't think I would really want to continue to do that so much. I like coming to Philly to rehearse because it's very relaxing. It sort of gets me out of the city. It's a nice ride down. And I have good friends on the way and here in Philly. So it's a nice alternative for me to come here to rehearse for the time being.
Can you ever show up at someone else's concert with your cello and just sit in? Do people show up and sit in anymore?
I think people do sit in. Of course, the kind of music that I play is sort of its own language, and I am familiar with that language. Of course, I'm familiar with other musical languages as well. Being a cellist, it's a little more difficult to sit in, because I can't just sort of walk up to the stand and take out my horn and start blowing in the microphone. But I have sat in the past. I remember very, very distinctly, I used to sit in with Jackie Byard and Major Holly at Bradley's. And that was a fantastic experience. That must have been about 8 or 9 years ago, and I had a great time doing it. And I remember actually that the whole club, it's a very, very noisy club, but for some reason, after I played, I think it was Autumn Leaves, I'm not sure, the whole club was like as quiet as you could hear a pin drop, as you say. And it was really quite a remarkable experience. I remember that very well.
Well, if you could hear a pin drop at Bradley's, either everybody was unexpectedly gagged or they were listening very intently. It's a
yes.
real noisy place.
Yes, it really is.
Do you get to hear much in New York? Can you, as a musician, take advantage of the music that the city has to offer?
Well, I don't go out that much as I used to, partly because I don't find the clubs as conducive to listening, or I just don't have like a home club that I used to, which used to be Rashid Ali's Ali's Alley, which I used to go to quite a bit. And I haven't been going that much, although I did hear a very fine concert just recently, which was Sunday night, which was Interpretations of Monk, and it had Don Cherry and Steve Lacy and a number of other very fine musicians, and that was very, very enjoyable.
Have you heard cellists start to listen to you and figure out what you're doing yet?
I can't say that I really have, but I'm sure there are people listening to what I'm doing. Of course, it takes quite a bit of determination and to play this kind of music on the cello, because there aren't really that many opportunities to play. I mean, there aren't that many bands that have cellists, and either you're going to be a sideman and play in somebody else's band, or you're going to lead your own band and write your own music, which is what I'm doing. So there aren't really that many opportunities for people to play the cello in this music still.
Well, I wish you luck with your music and your record label, and I hope that you play in Philadelphia sometime soon, and we can get to hear how the trio sounds. David Egis has been my guest, and I'm going to play another selection from his new album, a series of duets with Byard Lancaster. It's called The Arrow, and we're going to hear Oasis, which is a short piece. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it, David?
Sure. That's the only through composed and the only piece that's completely composed on this record, The Arrow. It's very short. It has a very lyrical line for Byard on soprano saxophone. And that's really about it for the Oasis. And I'd just like to thank you very much for having you on the show.
I'm glad you're able to come. And
thank you.
Good luck.
Right.
This is Oasis, David Egis, the composer, on cello, and Byard Lancaster on soprano. We just heard another selection from David Egis' new album, The Arrow. That was called Oasis. And it's on David's own album, which is called, own label, which is called Music Unlimited. So 20 minutes to 4, this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I just want to mention again, you know, David Aegis has been playing with Sonny Murray and Byard Lancaster, and as I said before, although that trio won't be performing in Philadelphia anytime in the very near future, Sonny Murray will be performing this Saturday night at a Foxhall performance at the International House, and it's the group Drums Interactual, which is a percussion group with Sonny Murray, Con Jamal, Ed Blackwell, Steve McCall, and Dennis Charles. In a half hour on Fresh Air, Bill Siemering will be with us. Bill is WUHY station manager, and he visits with us once a month on Fresh Air to talk about program schedule changes and special upcoming programs. As usual, when he joins us, we'll open up the phones for your questions and comments.